Yeah, Sora 2 is, I think, the Vibe video producing app. The Claude is the Vibe coding. Vibe thinking, Vibe everything going on.
I'm just Vibe living at this point.
Exactly, exactly, right?
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of cutting-edge minds to help you digest the week's news in artificial intelligence. This week, we've got a classic MOE panel, which I'm very excited about. We've got Kate Soule, Director of Technical Product Management for Granite, Kush Varshney, IBM Fellow AI Governance, and Kautar El-Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist and Manager for the Hybrid Cloud Platform. We have so many different kinds of AI models to talk about this week. We're going to be talking about Granite 4, Sonnet 4.5, Sora 2. We're also going to talk about these new e-commerce features that OpenAI has announced with ChatGPT. And we're actually doing a bonus segment with Matt from Security Intelligence, so stay tuned for that. But first, I really wanted to turn to Eily, who's going to give us the news.
Hey everyone, I'm Eily McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. I'm here with a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. Meta will soon show ads on your Facebook and Instagram accounts, drawing on conversations you had with its AI assistant. The jury, however, is still out on whether this move is clever or creepy. First, we had Vibe coding, and now Microsoft has introduced Vibe working. This refers to an AI agent that will write docs, crunch numbers in Excel, and design PowerPoint slides for you. Next time you order in, you might want to take a closer look at your delivery man. DoorDash has released Dot, an AI robot that can cross bike lanes, parking lots, even sidewalks, to bring you those late-night bites you're craving. There's some exciting new talent in Hollywood. Several agencies are attempting to sign Tilly, an entirely AI-generated actress. What do you think? Could Tilly be considered for an Academy Award? Let us know your thoughts in the comments. Subscribe to the Think newsletter for more AI insights. And now, back to the episode.
So I want to jump right into it and talk a little bit about Granite 4. Kate, you're on the panel. You've been obviously very close to this. What's coming out with Granite 4? What's exciting? What should people be paying attention to?
We're really excited to announce Granite 4 was launched on Hugging Face this past Thursday. The models feature a range of very efficient, smaller language models. So they're really designed for developers to pick them up, play with them, deploy them, as well as for enterprise customers that are looking for models and options for LLMs that don't require 8 H100s to host. So these models all can fit on a single GPU, including like an L40S A100, like much cheaper GPU options, thanks to their new hybrid architecture, which helps gain some memory efficiencies.
Yeah, that's great. And is the right way of thinking about it? Like, what is the delta, you think, between, say, Granite 3 and Granite 4, right? Like, has the team been kind of like focusing on particular things? It sounds like a little bit of what you're saying is like, the trend of small being beautiful is kind of like continuing with Granite 4. Curious if there's other kind of folks, things that like the team has been really focused on.
Yeah, so with Granite 4, we're definitely doubling down on small, efficient models. But even the smallest Granite 4 model, which takes like maybe 4 gigabytes, even running 128K context length, outperforms the biggest Granite 3 model. So we're reducing the memory footprint while improving the size. We also were able to secure ISO 42001 certification for this family of models right before the release. So Granite is now one of the first, if not the first, open source models out on Hugging Face that has ISO 42001 certification, showing just the degree of governance, safety, and security that we put into our AI model development system.
So I think this is great. And I think particularly with Kautar and Kush, there's a couple other angles I sort of wanted to bring into the Granite 4 story. Kush, maybe we can pick up on this last point, which I think is a really interesting one, is, you know, I think one of the constant fears, and I'll just be candid about open source, has always been, well, does open source mean that people are just going to be releasing models with not a whole lot of governance, not a whole lot of safety? I know one of the projects, and I think, Kate, you've talked about it before, that Granite, the Granite team has been focused on is kind of safety and compliance. And I guess I'm curious if you want to give kind of a sense of like how this is evolving in open source generally. Is Granite kind of an outlier here, or is it kind of like sort of leading the way of kind of like a whole trend of doing more of this kind of work when we do new open source releases?
Yeah, so I think it's part of a trend, but I think we're ahead, right? So there's this...
I know you're biased or anything.
Just a little bit. The Stanford Transparency Index has been out for a couple of years, and it's been tracking, how transparent are different models, different actually processes for the model building itself, right? So with that, we've been interacting with the Stanford team. That's been really great. They should be coming out with their next leaderboard pretty soon, and hopefully we'll be doing well on that. And so that shows the trend. This ISO 42001 is a great sort of testament to the overall process. The broader team has been undertaking. So I think all of that is part of it. We also have been cryptographically signing the models for the first time. So that's a new feature, another type of transparency, another type of verification.
What does that get you, actually? This is the first time I'm hearing about something like that.
Oh, yeah. So the idea is like when you're training a model, there's checkpoints, right, along the way. And like, who knows what happened? No one can really know unless there's some sort of ability to verify this thing. And so you can actually have this cryptographic signing mechanism in there, and then you release those like the keys, I guess, the cryptographic signature out, and then someone can go back and actually verify that yes, this is what happened. This is the way that the training actually was done. So. All of that is amazing stuff, and really excited to see where this goes next.
Counselor, a question I had for you was, Kate made a crack about it a little bit earlier, but as someone who's always kind of dreamed of owning a multi-GPU rig at home, it kind of seems like these like small models are getting like really, 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 really powerful. and I guess I should just ask the question of just like, it kind of feels like you actually don't need a whole lot of hardware to do some pretty incredible things right now. And it's just like, is that trend going to continue? Like, it kind of feels like, Tim, the idea that you would want to buy a multi-GPU rig at home is kind of almost like an absurd thing to do now, just given how great small models are.
Yeah, I think we have a great proof point here with the Granite models, the tiny models. So while everyone else is racing to make these bigger models, the frontier models, I think IBM is fundamentally changing the question from how do we make these models bigger to how do we really make them smarter per compute? And I think this is really very important, because the numbers that we see with Granite, like Kate mentioned, really tell a great story. 72% almost, less memory, half the model size or even less, better performance, even 4x. Or more longer context, and can run on consumer GPUs. I think this is really great. This isn't about being competitive on benchmarks. This is really about redefining what good means, from most capable to most efficient, and also being capable. So like you're saying, we probably, don't need these huge, multi-GPU machines especially for special use cases, enterprise focused. I think efficiency really matters. And I think this is really strategic brilliance from IBM, looking at this trajectory of AI development, saying that, the trend that we're seeing is unsustainable. And so, but when we look at the business, what it needs, compute costs are rising exponentially, regulatory pressure is mounting, enterprise customers care about TCO more than the leaderboards, and also the environmental costs are becoming impossible to externalize. So I think that's really, I think it's a win story here that we have with Granite 4, and also the architectural innovations with this hybrid architecture. I think it's really a huge leap forward, because this entire architectural shift to Bamba is a bet that state space models, I think, are the future. Because transformers dominated here for a while, they scaled well, but also they scale very expensively. So if we really can deliver these comparable results with a much more efficient architecture, I think it's a great story.
Well, Kate, to round out the segment, and I think this is probably the worst possible question to ask someone right after a big launch, is Granite 5. What can we expect for Granite 5?
It's too soon to start talking about Granite 5, Tim. We're still really excited for Granite 4, but there's a lot going to come next with Granite 4. So we've got models that will feature like thinking style reasoning capabilities coming down the road. We've got smaller models, even than our tiny 3B model coming down the road. So think like in the 100 millions of parameters. So those are going to be really cool.
It's coming
for
back.
Edge. Yep. Again, and we are going bigger. So we will be able to take this efficient architecture and scale it and see similar gains in efficiency, but deploy it at a bigger size. So there's a lot of exciting work ahead. And we're really excited to do all of this work in the open and share it with the broader community.
Nice. That's great. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on that. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. And in some ways, this episode has become very model heavy, actually, in some ways, because we're going to talk a little bit about Claude Sonnet 4.5. And we're going to talk about Sora 2, right, the new OpenAI video model. But let's talk a little bit about Sonnet 4.5 first, dropped just earlier this week. And Kush, maybe I'll start with you. I think one of the most interesting things about this drop, I keep calling it a drop, this release, is that, you know, early on, like, I think these models and foundation model companies often advertise themselves as jack of all trades. We're going to launch a model and we're going to show you benchmarks across everything you might want to use it for. But this release is like very coding focused, right? The whole blog post is Sonnet 4.5. You use it for coding. It's great at coding. Did we remind you how much good it does at coding? And this is a little bit weird. I mean, a few weeks back, we talked about this NDER paper that came out where people looked at, say, what people actually use ChatGPT for. And it turns out like coding is actually like a really, really small segment of like the overall use case for, you know, ChatGPT, which is like maybe the most widely deployed, you know, service in the space. I guess maybe a question to you, Kush, is like, why are we really narrowing how we sell, talk about, focus these models? Because it seems like very clear that Anthropic's making a bet that like what you really should think of these models for is for coding.
Yeah, it actually relates to what Kautar was saying about Granite, right? What is Granite useful for? It's for those enterprise use cases where we can be very specific. And if you don't have a user in mind and you're creating a model, you're creating a system, then you're kind of in a weird position that what is it really good for? So I think it's actually, I mean, makes sense for Anthropic to pick a lane and be like, this is what we're going for. And coding happens to be the one that they've gone for. We'll, I mean, talk about the other models later on. And I think they're starting to pick their lanes as well. So from that point of view, I think it's good. And I mean, the size being huge is maybe what is needed for that kind of use case for the coding assistant. And we've been experimenting, and I mean, and we're finding Anthropic's models to be the ones that you do want to go for coding. So they have the success there, so they're building on it and keep going down that route. Yeah,
for sure. And I guess Kautar, on this front, you know, we're guilty of this ourselves at MOE, is we always say like the foundation model companies or like the AI companies. I guess this has me, you know, Kush's response has me thinking a little bit about like, does that even make sense anymore? Like, I don't know, is OpenAI really competitive with Anthropic over time if it turns out that they're going to be kind of pointing their models at pretty radically different things? You know, we used to talk about AGI, general intelligence. It seems like we're headed to ASI, which is like specific intelligence, right? Or like super specific intelligence, ASSI, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see how all of these shifts are happening. Of course, I think when we started, the foundation models was like one model that rules them all, and then you can, you know, specialize. But now you're seeing the shifts to like, now, you know, it's really important, given the cost and all of these things, the sustainability issues, we need to go the route of the specific models. But I think it's going to be a hybrid approach, because the training strategy that we're doing, this pre-training, it still uses the foundational models kind of principles, which is still going to be important. It's just, how do you guide these models? What are efficient techniques that you can use to train, pre-train, but also to, you know, in the inference scaling paradigm, which becomes also super important to guide these models real time to do the right things, you know, at the least possible cost, you know, possible. So I think those strategies are becoming super important, focusing more on what can I get these models to do during inference as opposed to pre-training, because I think the flexibility that we need to augment these models with during inference is becoming also super important, especially in dynamic environments where you don't have enough data or you're seeing these new situations and you need the model to be flexible to adapt. But, if we talk about, you know, Claude, you know, the Sonnet 4.5, I really like, you know, this developer-focused strategy, which is a developer-first strategy, which gives Claude the focus to continue to innovate, you know, for the software engineering tasks and so on. I think, which is great. I think that this latest release, I feel it's a big leap, especially with the 30 hours reasoning capability they have. I think that's really huge.
Kate, tucked away at the bottom of the blog post for 4.5 was one of the weirdest, coolest research demos it's been my pleasure to see recently. It was a demo called Imagine with Claude. And it looks like a Claude interface, but you would say, oh, I really want an app that does this. And it would, in effect, generate that on the fly for you. And I had a lot of fun creating an imaginary terminal that called an imaginary Hugging Face for an imaginary model and having a conversation with it. But it was just like very fun to play with and was like a very different interaction from chatbots, right? And I guess I'm kind of curious to get your thoughts on what you thought about the demo and whether or not what they're kind of showing off there might really look like the future. I think what they're proposing is in the future, you don't have software, you just say what you want and then the software kind of appears. Is that where we're headed?
So, I mean, I think Claude was very specific calling this Imagine with Claude demo an experiment. It's certainly something that they're throwing out there. You know, this idea that we're not going to have this pre-canned software. We're going to start to just create software as we go about our day-to-day and live our lives. And, oh, I need to do XYZ. Let's create some custom software for that. I think there's a lot of practicalities that need to be solved before that becomes a reality. Let's put it that way. Platforms exist for a reason. You know, investing in things at scale that many people are going to be using work for a reason versus custom coming up with one bespoke piece of software for every single task is going to be inefficient for every single thing. But I could see us getting to a hybrid world where we start to empower folks. I mean, is it that different from how people use things like Airtable and kind of other lightweight, no coding based solutions to spin up a new like database or kind of website to help them do X, Y, or Z? I think it's just maybe a new riff on that, but more powered with LLMs and maybe a little bit more sophisticated.
So ultimately, you're a little skeptical.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be like a personal, you know, kind of day-to-day saver, not necessarily the new way that enterprises run their business.
Yeah, like, I guess I agree with you that I have a hard time imagining like a bank is going to be like, well, let's just like come up with some kind of payments processing infrastructure on the fly. Well, this is a great time, I think, to bring in a kind of third model into the discussion. One of the big news stories of the week, of course, has been OpenAI releasing its latest Sora 2 model. And, you know, we've been thinking about it very much in terms of models and talking about models, you know, on this episode. But I think the right way to think about Sora 2 is actually it's an app launch more than anything else, right? It's not just an incredible kind of video generation model, but it also is like this mobile first social experience that they're trying to create. And I guess, Kush, maybe to toss it back to you because you got the original version of this question, it's like, it sure seems like OpenAI, you know, whereas Anthropic really wants to focus on coding, OpenAI is thinking about it very much as like a almost like a consumer, if not an entertainment use for this technology. And do you think this kind of shows like that they really are kind of seriously differentiating into that space?
Yeah, I think that's it. So Sora 2 is, I think, the Vibe video producing app. I mean, the Claude is the vibe coding. We have Femune vibe thinking, vibe everything going on.
I'm
right?
just vibe living at this point.
Exactly, you know, so. Exactly, right? And it's the same issue though, right? I mean, it's an app, it's fun, it can be used for a bunch of things, but once you get to like the serious end of things, that's where, I mean, you need to, I mean, put in those extra sort of processes, a lot of the great security, the great robustness. I mean, all of that sort of thing applies no matter what you start vibing on, right? So so I think, like, in general, in anything that you're producing, I mean, there's some initial provocation, some initial thinking. You maybe get to a prototype, and then you take that prototype and make it into the eventual product. And yeah, I think we're kind of closing the gap between those two ends. And that's great because the speed of innovation, the speed of production can happen. But then there still needs to be that other side. I mean, just the provocative prototype isn't the product, right? So so I think that's where we still need to finish the job in the right way.
Kay, have you played with it yet? I'm kind of curious if you've...
I haven't played with it yet, but maybe just building on that last question, I think what's really interesting is both Claude and OpenAI, Anthropic rather, and OpenAI, with these model releases have really focused on the application. I mean, a huge part of the Anthropic release blog was focused on Claude Code, right? Versus just the endpoints themselves. And so we see these frontier model providers really focusing at a different layer at the stack, and I think that's going to continue. And I really think that the open source community needs to figure out a way to compete at that same level. Because I think if we're going to continue to have open source AI thrive, we need to empower the community to do more versus just download the weights and take them off and run with them. So I'd love to see more work going on there. The things that I did see with the Sora 2 release, I mean, can we talk about the branding move, Jujitsu, that they did, calling deepfakes cameos, basically? Like, so you can now take a video of yourself and impose it into video or your friends, and you can share these deepfakes, let's call them for what they are, of yourselves and cameo yourself into videos. So I see a lot of concerning issues with that, as well as more broadly some of the things they're working on. But it certainly is an interesting update to the ecosystem.
Yeah, so a lot to run through there. I think maybe let's pick up on that last point is, you know, obviously one of the kind of responses to the Sora 2 release was in some ways kind of like a collective horror around like this technology. And I think I heard two things from friends and, you know, on the social media chatter, right? Like one of them was what you're saying, which is they're doing deepfakes. They're just calling it cameos. And then the second one was like, have we created like the quote unquote infinite slot machine? Like, are we just creating like this like shallow video that's going to just like keep us like strapped to our phone forever? On that last one, I mean, do you think those risks are real? Like, do we feel like this is going to be like, this is really changing the nature of content in a way that might be unhealthy?
I think there's significant risks and they are real. And I mean, OpenAI did try and address some of it in their release. They talked about, you know, doom scrolling and things they're doing to help prevent it. I think they have some sort of recommendation filtering an algorithm that you can customize with natural language. I don't see how that helps. If I can tell you more specifically what I want to see, I would think that improves
just, like,
the
could
doom
go
scrolling.
In the other direction,
but,
maybe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But who knows? Like I said, I haven't had a chance to try it out specifically. But I do think there's a real risk here of, you know, what value is this really driving? And do we have the right safeguards in place to drive important things like creativity and expression without kind of enabling mass disinformation, mass slop, you know, kind of reducing the human experience of creativity.
And the other thing I'd love to get your comment on, you know, just again, pulling from the Granite discussion, right, is I think you were sort of making an argument that, look, open source has been really focused on the model. And like what you see all these big companies moving towards is competing on interface. And I guess the kind of question for you is, you know, do you think open source, like, kind of has the chops to go and compete at that layer? I still remember, what is it? Libre Office, right? It was the open source office. And it was great because, like, I don't know, it's open or software, but like interface wise, it had its challenges. And like one argument is like, maybe this has always been kind of a challenge for open source. Do you think this time is maybe different, or is there like similar kind of difficulties?
Look, the world runs on Linux, and open source software and code all the time without while putting your own user experience on front of it. So I think we need to get to a similar paradigm with open source AI, where we're enabling the community to engage more at the kind of application framework level versus just the pure model weights. And then that empowers, you know, individual companies, individuals to go out and create their own versions that are going to power their businesses and their lives. So, you know, I think it's going to be a mix. I think we see this pattern in open source software development all the time. And there's no reason. I mean, this is one part of the stack that doesn't require, you know, hundreds of GPUs burning in order to contribute. So we actually can engage in a more meaningful way with, I think, a lot of the open source developer community than you can in the training portion of the kind of stack itself. So I see there's a ton of opportunity there if we can kind of coalesce around some of these broader patterns and applications that we think we're going to need to drive success.
Yeah, for sure. Kautar, maybe a final question on this. I was once standing in a data center when someone started like a fine-tuning run, and you hear like all the GPUs like turn on and like the room gets really hot really quickly. And I think a little bit about like the amount of compute that goes into powering a like mass rollout of a video generation model. And OpenAI can't be making money on this, right? Like this is like an enormous increase in their burn rate to offer it at these prices, I suppose is the way to think about it. How sustainable is this, right? Like, do we think that like in 4 or 5 years, you will have access to these kinds of models at these prices? Or is it just kind of like, this is a demo for the moment to show off the technology, and like the business model is ultimately going to be, you're going to pay a lot more for getting access to this kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't think they probably have a good answer to all of these questions. Like yeah. These companies are thinking about these things. it's of course, you know, there's a lot of work, you know, to work on next generation AI hardware, like with these technologies like neuromorphic and in-memory computing and 3D integration, packaging, lots, you know, IBM also is doing tons of innovation in that space. So that has to continue to drive more efficiency all the way down to the silicon level and even invent or innovate in other technologies like phase change memory or others, you know, where you're combining both compute and memory together. Those are crucial, you know, to continue to advance. But if we just want to look at these maybe two profiles, you know, the Sora and the Sonnet. So the recent AI update, you know, to the tools, like, you know, take 3.4 million joules to produce a 5-second 16 FPS video, which is equivalent to running a microwave for over an hour. So this is some recent statistics. So for Sora 2, like the inference cost is extremely high per generation. And the use frequency, it's episodic here. So user creates few videos and the compute pattern, you are seeing massive bursts, could be infrequent depending on the usage. But if there is mass adoption of these things, you can imagine, you know, the pressure this puts on compute and the energy. If I look at Claude, so, you know, in their pricing, it remains the same as Claude 4, so which is about like $3 to $15 per million tokens. And they can run autonomously for 30 hours on complex multi-step tasks. So in terms of the inference cost, it's, you know, compared to the video one, it's moderate per token, but it's continuous. It's, you know, runs for hours and days. So it's like, if you look at Sora, it's like a sports car, incredible power in short bursts, expensive per mile, while Claude 4.5, it's maybe like a semi truck, moderate power, but runs, you know, 24 hours, you know, it's like a hauling cargo here. So, of course, there are implications here, and I think we need to look at this holistically. What is the cost? How sustainable is this? I think right now we're in the phase of proving the technology, proving the capabilities, but to do this in massive production, get that scale, there is a lot of more work to be done to optimize that stack.
Yeah, it makes me think a little bit, too. We've talked about inference, but what's also quite unique here is that like text is like really cheap to store. Right. But like if this goes well, you're talking about like YouTube levels of just storage that you need to do, which is like quite a different thing altogether. Also, like in some ways, like there's the inference cost, but increasingly also just like the storage cost becomes really expensive if the idea is we're going to just store whatever video you created indefinitely.
Store and then maybe train on it. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, ultimately, yeah, there's the train element as well. So we'll have to see how this all unfolds. I'll move us on to our kind of like final topic of the day, which is another release from OpenAI. But I think it's worth raising in kind of the context of the discussion we've been having so far today, right? I think we've talked a lot about what's happening in open source, how the big kind of foundation model companies are maybe differentiating with time. And this one seems to be maybe like another kind of indicator of maybe how differentiated some of these companies are becoming. So basically OpenAI, they released a thing called Buy with ChatGPT, which is the idea that ultimately GPT will be able to be kind of an e-commerce agent for you and will go out and be able to make purchases on your behalf. And, you know, we talked about AP2 last week, which is the Google payment protocol. It sounds like OpenAI, not to be left behind, is also announcing its own sort of agentic payment protocol. But let me kind of just go to a very basic question is like, do you think there's enough trust in products like ChatGPT to like have them do purchases on your behalf? Like, I guess part of me is always wondering, like, at what point do I feel comfortable giving agents access to my wallet? And that feels like a big question for this market.
I mean, I'm not going to give ChatGPT access to my Fidelity account, but maybe my credit card where I can refute a charge that was made that I don't agree with.
It's like, it's kind of like it's working up to some parts of your payments.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think there's plenty of trust for OpenAI to try and optimize the user experience on purchasing. They've got all the incentives in place. I do not trust OpenAI with, you know, my personal conversations and how they handle all sorts of mental health issues and Sora 2 deepfakes and everything else. But I think their incentives are pretty well aligned to kind of user needs when it comes to pushing dollars through their platform. So I think it makes sense. They're clearly targeting kind of wide consumer reach and audience. I think there probably will be plenty of trust there for giving ChatGPT your credit card and seeing what happens. Now, will the banks trust? It would be interesting to see how the credit card companies work out refuted transactions that ChatGPT made. And does that count as a fraudulent transaction, X, Y, and Z? That could be really interesting to see that play out a little bit.
Yeah, I think the contracting element of this is really interesting. I also love kind of, I'm getting a vibe of like Kate's like kind of frenemies approach to these companies where it's like, well, here the incentives are aligned. I have no problem with it. Here the incentives seem really disaligned. I feel bad about it.
So, yeah, there you go.
Well, actually, on incentives, I mean, Kush, one of the maybe conspiracy theories that came up around this launch was, well, the minute you start talking purchases, you start talking ads, ultimately, right? Which is like, well, you have an agent that's going to buy stuff on your behalf. Wouldn't someone pay to be the product that ChatGPT recommends? Is that where we're headed with some of these products? Like that, like ads is going to be, you know, everything old is new again. And maybe ChatGPT really is kind of just the new Google. Do you think that's where we're going to end up?
Not sure about that, actually, because if we look historically, things like M-Pesa in East Africa came about so you could do purchases through your phone and have your mobile wallets and these sort of things. There's this whole thing of UPI in India and like, kind of the middleware in some sense for the purchasing of things. And once you get ads in there, I mean, it just isn't the thing. I think really it's getting money to flow through your system and take a little bit of a cut somehow, somewhere. And I think that's the bigger story here. Because like ads can come in, they can do something or the other, but like what really makes the world go around is like, where does the money flow? Like if you can capture that, then you're really golden. And I think government regulation needs to step in very quickly on this because this is a very critical infrastructure sort of piece for not just individual countries, but for the global finance system. And I think if we just let this go without having like a kind of like a public sort of facing point of view on this, then it'll be a little bit of a challenge getting out of it because Once there's kind of corporate capture of these sort of things, the infrastructure is in place and then you can't really undo it. So that's kind of my biggest concern on this.
Yeah, and I think regulatory aspect of this is going to get very interesting. It's just like, how do you step in? What are the rules that you need to put in place? So maybe a final question, we'll kind of close out. Kautar, I'll give you the last word is, imagine I'm the CEO of Amazon. I'm on my yacht sipping my martinis or whatever that the CEO of Amazon does. Am I worried by where this is all going? As kind of like the internet's prominent e-commerce provider that has kind of sold everything now, right? Like they like do groceries, they do books, they do everything. Do developments like this, like, are they a threat to companies like Amazon?
I would be worried. You know, I think OpenAI here is trying to differentiate itself and trying also to have a big play in the agentic commerce. So they're, I think, trying to ship fast all the experience, build also the protocol around what actually works. They're using this ACP protocol, agentic commerce protocol. And of course, right now it's Stripe-centric, but theoretically it's open to others. They open source, you know, the code that lets other merchants use also their interface and so on, so they can open up also for other merchants. So I think they're trying to bet on the first mover advantages in agentic commerce. And it's for them, I think it matters more, I think, than maybe perfect interoperability, which Google Play is more focused on. So they're willing to kind of accept somewhat a centralized solution like Stripe as the hub in exchange of velocity, really getting this to work fast. If you look at what Google's Play, they're trying to build a consortium first here, get the buy-in from 60 more partners to ensure true interoperability using the AP2 protocol, which is more ambitious architecturally. But you know, I think it's betting on that the winner will be whoever creates the standard that everyone adopts, not whoever ships first. So I think OpenAI theory here is trying to own the user experience, control the transaction, kind of become the front door to commerce, which is, of course, a threat to Amazon. While Google's theory is setting the standards, be the protocol player here, but don't own any one experience. But if you look at Anthropic's theory, be kind of the best tool that developers and businesses can use to build their own experiences. So I think everybody is trying to bet on one strategy, one angle, and we'll have to see how all of these things play together. But it's interesting to watch.
Kate, Kush, Kautar, this is one of my favorite panels. Hopefully we'll have everybody back on real soon. But that is all the time that we have for today. And next up, we're going to have a quick segment with Matt Kaczynski to do a cybersecurity segment. Well, Matt, we're really glad to have you on the show. For our listeners, Matt Kaczynski is the host of Security Intelligence, a new podcast that has just launched focusing on cybersecurity questions. And we want to have you on the show because it is national, I believe, Cybersecurity Month.
That's correct.
And I guess, Matt, just to maybe like kick off the discussion, maybe just to riff on that last segment a little bit, strikes me that like once we start using AIs for payments, it's going to get hacked super quickly. And so I'm kind of curious if you want to give like a little bit of a security gloss on that last discussion. Like, how is that space evolving? Are we all screwed? You know, I just like want to learn a little bit about that because certainly people are going to be using these products. That means they're going to get burned using these products too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So first off, thanks for having me here, Tim. First time, long time. But yeah, you know, it's interesting, right? Because the last episode we did of Security Intelligence this week, I asked the panel right off the bat. I said, what's the one thing you would not trust your AI agent to do for you? And what was really interesting to me was the first answer I got from Jeff Kroom, a distinguished inventor here at IBM, said anything, right? For Jeff's money right now, he feels like it's too early in the game to be connecting this stuff to anything, really. And the other panelists kind of agreed, because here's the interesting thing about the AI agents and the way that they're different from some of the other security challenges we've faced in the past, is that you're not hacking these things the same way you would say, like, I don't know, a piece of software, your traditional piece of software, right? You're not exploiting some kind of bug in the code. You're not dropping a payload or writing a script. You're basically social engineering these things, right? If you say the right words to these things, you can get them to do some pretty malicious stuff. And so the question that raises for cybersecurity experts today is, okay, we don't really know how to stop people from getting socially engineered. How do you stop an AI from getting socially engineered? And that's the big question, right? That's what people are trying to figure out in the space today.
Yeah, I think it makes me think a little bit about, I mean, so these are papers I'm kind of obsessed with in the AI space, which are like, oh, like if you are encouraging to your AI, it performs better. You know, like you tell it, like, it's really important to my job for you to get this right, and the AI does better. And it's kind of interesting that you use the phrase kind of social engineering, because the way we try to get humans to be better at social engineering is like we literally show them like documentation where like you should ask a question if someone is asking for your password. Do we need to do that as like fine tuning for our models? Like, do we train them to get better at social engineering using the exact same methods that we use to get humans to be better at social engineering?
You know, I think that we kind of do, actually, right? And it's a question of figuring out what that education looks like. Again, going back to the conversation that I had with the panelists on our episode this week, they all kind of landed at what we need is some kind of real-world version of Asimov's three laws of robotics, right? But for teaching our AI agents and whatnot to avoid or maybe better detect social engineering. With, again, the caveat that all this education we've put into people, it still hasn't stopped it. People still get scammed, and they probably will get scammed forever. So in some ways, it's like, look, we may never stop the AIs from getting scammed, but if we can set up some kind of standard universal approach to telling them what to watch out for, maybe we can cut down on it a little bit more like we cut down on it with people.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I think, tell us a little bit more about the new show. So I understand that it launched fairly recently.
Yes.
And what will you guys be focusing on? I know we've been talking AI just because MOE is like AI pilled, but it
yes,
sounds like
of course.
Cybersecurity might be a much broader focus for you guys.
Absolutely. So we basically, to be frank, we ripped off your format for MOE. We do a, we get a week. Hey, you guys, you hit something good. We just took it. So we get a panel going every week, three experts and myself, and we sit down and we break down the latest stories in cybersecurity. Granted, a lot of it does have to do with AI because this is a new technology, right? And so security experts are trying to figure out what do we do with it. But we also cover a ton of other stuff too, right? You know, your DDoS attacks, your, new app vulnerabilities, big hacks, that kind of stuff. And then we've also got coming up soon some pretty special one-on-one in-depth interview episodes with some experts that are a little more narratively focused. That's going to be a kind of bonus thing we do. But that's the kind of gist of the show.
Nice. That's great. Well, if people want to find out more about it, where do they find you? Where do they find the show?
Absolutely. Head over to the IBM YouTube technology, the IBM technology YouTube channel. And then, of course, we're also found wherever podcasts are hosted. Security Intelligence is the name of it. Go type that in, search it out. You'll find us.
Nice. Well, Matt, we'll have you back on MOE sometime. And thanks for joining us today.
I would love to. Thank you, Tim.
And that's all the time that we have for today. If you enjoyed the episode, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.